The Seven Myths of Golf with PGA professional Billy Bondurek.
This is Golf Smarter. Each week you'll get inside information on how to lower your scores through strategy and course management. We'll ask course pros, designers, and architects to reveal their secrets in an effort to improve your game. If you're a beginner or a seasoned pro, subscribe to the Golf Smarter podcast. Here's your host, Fred Green.
Welcome and thanks for downloading the Golf Smarter podcast. To those members of the Shivas Iron Society, if you're a new member or an old member, welcome. We're glad you can join the team. Hey, stay tuned for the close of today's show and we'll tell you about how you could win a limited edition signed copy of Michael Murphy's Golf in the Kingdom. If you entered one of our contests, you'll notice that I do my best to email you back so that we can have a dialogue going. And if you have a comment or suggestion for Golf Smarter, I'm really open to your input and appreciate it very much. So thanks to those who've written, and I hope to hear from you soon. Now, I first discovered this week's guest while reading some articles at PGA.com, where he's a regular contributor. I enjoyed what I read and felt that his comments and thought process were perfect for what we're trying to learn on the Golf Smarter podcast. I've always thought that the longest 6 inches in golf are between our ears. And Billy Bondurek seems to agree. Welcome, Billy.
Thanks, Fred.
How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Now, you've got a really interesting website, the7mythsofgolf.com. And have some really interesting concepts that are going, but just the introduction alone, when I was reading it, it screamed out you had to be on the Golf Smarter podcast. Now, you asked a couple questions here. What would it feel like to walk on the first tee of a golf course and have the same level of comfort as the top players in the game? And how would you feel without the anxiety of wondering whether or not your opening tee shot was going to land somewhere on the golf course? So just those questions alone is what everybody wants to have answered.
Huh.
Help us.
With that?
Obi-Wan Kenobi, help us.
Hey, yeah. That's,
tell us about the seven myths of golf.
Well, the seven myths of golf, it kind of dismisses some of the stuff that have been taught for years to golfers. Keep your head still, keep your eye on the ball, left arm straight, a lot, you know, the technical stuff. And I try to get past that stuff because I'm not really a real believer in the conventional methods. I've seen way too many good players throughout my days play golf with none of some of that stuff happening. And in the Seven Myths of Golf, it disproves it, and it shows it with video. The book takes a different turn and starts getting a little bit deeper into the true nature of how I see golf. And what I find with golf is it can show us so much more in life. For example, we're out there walking around in nature, and nature itself has a way of showing us the perfection of this world. And it has no need for being right or wrong or good or bad. It just simply is. And you know, if my golf course caught a deer, you know, see a deer cross the fairway, that it's just, it has no need to explain himself. And if your awareness is in the here and now, you can see this whole scheme of things teach us to see how perfect our life is as we're playing golf. And it sways us away from the big troublemaker, which is me. And a little bit more on that that topic of me. We all have it. It's our ego. And when we tee the ball up on the first hole, I think there's two distinctive things that occur in all of us. One is our desire, and the other is our fear. And from that, it's like an open slate. We can play some really poor golf because of those two things. But when we can kind of push those aside and just play from the here and now, we're so much better off. And I've got a couple of stories about that if you're interested in hearing them.
I would love to.
One of the stories that comes to my mind is something that I think all of us will perhaps remember if you're into sports at all. In all three of these stories I'm going to tell you, kind of are interrelated. If you recall, once Michael Jordan running back and forth up the court, and he made 5 3-pointers in a row. And I think after the 5th 3-pointer, he was running back to his side, and he just looked up into the crowd and kind of just looked straight into a camera and threw his hands up. And the look on his face was just like, I don't know where this is coming from.
As you were describing it, I threw my hands up in the air with a face of inquisition saying, I don't know.
Exactly.
I knew exactly the moment you were talking about.
I think that's the first words out of his mouth when they interviewed him after the game. I don't know how it happened. Tiger Woods was once asked after, I think he won the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach. He hit a 6-iron out of the rough. I think it was on the 6th hole, the par 5 uphill, 220 yards into the wind, out of deep rough. Miraculous shot. Reporter asked him afterwards how it happened. He goes, you know, I don't remember. That often occurs to me when I hit my greatest shots. I don't remember anything about them. Now, this story is completely different than sports, but I was once watching Sir Laurence Olivier give a talk. He was talking about his acting career, and somebody had asked him a question about when he got involved with Shakespeare, and he told this story. It was very interesting. He said that he once did a Shakespearean play, Hamlet, over in Oxford, England, and he absolutely fell in love with the play. And each time they did a rehearsal, he could tell something strange was happening. It was different each time. On the opening night of his first of the play, he received a 20-minute standing ovation after he completed it. And he went down to his dressing room, and his best friends came down, and they said, Lawrence, that was the most incredible thing we've ever seen. And he was walking back and forth on the floor with his head down, and he looked up at them, and he snapped at them, and he said, well, don't you think I know that? And they were like, astonished by it. They said, Lawrence, what's the matter? That was the most incredible interpretation of Hamlet anyone's ever done. And he says, I know, but I don't know how I did it, and I don't know how I'll ever do it again. Now, all three of those stories involve a kind of a higher plane of intelligence that our mind can take us to. And when I speak of the mind, I'm not talking about our brain. I'm talking about something that's much greater than that. Our connection to our world, pretty much. But you'll never get there if you're involved with thinking about me. You have to lose all that stuff. You got to get away from what the shot means to you when you're teeing off, or if you have a good round going, you have to completely detach from what the outcome might be. And I think every golfer out there will agree with me. If they ever had a halfway decent round going, once they start thinking about it, they start telling stories in their own mind. It starts out with how they're going to explain the birdie putts they dropped to the guys in the grill afterwards. Or they even, you know, go into the opposite extreme and start explaining why the round went bad. Inside of all of us, I think we have that storytelling nature, and we have to get past it.
But we're not Michael Jordan, and we're not Sir Laurence Olivier, and we're not, I'm not a professional golfer. I go out to the golf course, A, because I love to, and B, because it's a distraction from everything else that's going on in my life. So when I stand over the ball, being in it in the here and now is a wonderful thing, but there are so many other distractions that come to mind when I do that.
When you stand over the ball?
When I stand over the ball. And when I'm walking to the ball and trying to think of what I want to do on my next shot. How can the everyday golfer... How can the amateur clear their head?
Let me ask you this, Fred.
Sure.
Have you ever hit a shot that you felt was just perfect?
Mm-hmm.
Where did it come from? Is it inside of us, or is it when we actually get away from our own self and just get up and hit it.
Oh, I'm sorry. You didn't hear my answer. I threw my hands up and my shoulders and made a face like, I don't know.
Exactly. When you,
but I don't know what happens when I make a crappy shot, too.
I think you're more tuned. You tune yourself more into the moment when you hit a good shot. But with golf, it is so easy to lose yourself. You're walking down the fairway, you're chatting, and things start going in your mind. And the next thing you know, you don't even realize it, but you left the present moment three holes earlier. And you had not been in that present moment for perhaps 45 minutes. Then all of a sudden it dawns on you. You haven't hit one shot from the now moment. I watched this on TV, the Golf Channel. I saw Bruce Litsky. He was doing one of those play with the pro things on the Golf Channel. And he said, yeah, I'm looking down the fairway now, and he's visualizing the shot for the camera. And he says, I like to aim the ball at that cloud up there, and I want to see it land off that left side of the fairway because it looks like it's going to bounce down towards the center from there. And he walks in his golf shot, and then he looks up into the camera, and he said the strangest thing. He said, now, you're going to find this really strange, but it's about this point right here that I feel like something leaves my body and watches from up above. I see that as purely detaching himself from what he just visualized. And I think that's a big problem with a lot of golfers. They get stuck in the visualization. They visualize the shot because Jack Nicklaus used to do it, and everybody talks about visualization. I'm not saying it doesn't work. It does. But you must detach from it. Otherwise, you'll be stuck in that beautiful golf shot you see, and you're never in the here and now moment for when you're actually swinging the club.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, please.
How?
How do you detach?
Yeah.
You have to look down the fairway and say, that hasn't happened yet. That's the future. I'm in the here and now. And, you know, it's crazy. I practice it. It sometimes takes me 1,000 balls consistently saying before each shot, well, that hasn't happened yet. I'm in the here and now. Stay in the here and now. You need to have some type of a cue that snaps you back into the present moment, because that's when all the good stuff will happen for you. You can get to the top of your golf swing, and your mind is in the future. You're thinking, well, I don't want to hit it left. So at the top of your golf swing, you're not there. You're already down the fairway hoping it won't go left. There's a trick to it, and there's a way to practice it. You can even see it on the great players on the tour. They can't seem to tap into it from week to week, but the finest players do. I don't know, this occurs a lot to the students I work with. I've asked them the question, when you hit a bad shot and you're out there by yourself, will you grab another ball and throw it down, and you just get up and you hit it? Have you ever just hit it dead, solid, perfect? And everybody says, oh, yeah, I've done that before. It's like the first guy got out of the way, and then the second guy got in there and said, well, you know, I know how to do this. I don't need to think about it. Going back to what I had said earlier, desire and fear, We all, and this is true of everything in life, we desire things to add to our life, and we fear losing things in our life. And if you look at it in our golf game, and I think this is why golf is so brilliant, it can really help you in life. You get up on a tee or stand over a putt, you may desire to make it. You may have the fear of missing it. Nothing good is going to happen in either of those two directions. It's only when you can step back from both of them and pretty much don't give a hoot of what happens. Visualize the good, but then when you're getting over the ball to hit it, be present and enjoy that moment. The moment leading up to all of this stuff, and it's the same thing in, say, knocking in a 10-foot putt that is going to beat your opponent. The whole process of actually lining it up and being excited about it, that's the moment that kind of defines whether the ball goes in or not. So much of our attention, though, gets put into the results that we lose that moment. But that sometimes is the most fun part of it. So that's where I'm at with, like, when you're learning your golf swing. You have to try to feel that stuff going on. There's an old story I remember about a, I think this is a true story, about a gentleman over in Italy. He got a job riding a bike, delivering bread. And he had to ride 10 miles uphill in one direction, delivering bread. And the other guy that worked there did the same thing, and they both had routes that were very similar. And one guy hated his job. He eventually hated his bike, and he kicked his dog when he came home. This other guy found a reason every day to enjoy his life. He liked the smell of the bread. He enjoyed the whole bike ride because it made his legs stronger and his heart stronger. One day, the owner of the bakery decided to expand, and he gave him the job managing the new bakery. It's kind of funny how this stuff rings true in everything we do, and it does in golf, too. If you're trying to learn something new in a golf swing, you have to enjoy the learning process. You can't see it as a struggle. If you do, not much good is going to come from it, and it'll truly be a struggle for you.
It's amazing how Tiger likes to learn things so much. I mean, where he'll change his swing, you know, he'll go ahead and win a couple majors and say, I need to change my swing.
Yeah.
Because he loves the learning process, right?
Yeah, I agree. Tiger is...
He's an anomaly.
Yeah, he is. He's almost a savant with a golf club in his hand.
Yeah, it's just so much fun. I mean, so many people, you know, and you're from Boston, you can tell with your accent, but you know, as from someone from Boston, you hate the Yankees, but you love to hate the winners. You know, you always want to root against, but with Tiger, it's different.
Oh, yeah, it is. I find
it's almost like Muhammad Ali. You just couldn't wait for him to fight again.
Uh-huh. I find it difficult to watch a golf tournament when he's not in it.
Absolutely.
And, you know, there's another very exciting player these days, and it's Mickelson.
But you're waiting to see Mickelson blow up.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you hope that he wins, but you know that something's going to happen or he's going to go, why did you do that?
Yeah. There's something going on with him. He certainly has a lot of knowledge for the game.
And he's a magician.
Yeah.
There's no question about it.
But there's a lack of wisdom. And you know, this is an interesting study I once heard some people do. You know those EKG machines you can hook up to your brain?
Sure.
Well, I guess there was some sports psychologists that got together and they said, well, can we hook that up to some of these athletes' heart? And I think it was like more along the lines for basketball players. That's what they did the study for. And somebody figured out a way how to do it. And they'd sit these guys down, and some of them were like NCAA double, you know, AA champs and guys that like had the ball the last 3 seconds and made like a three-pointer and stuff. And they'd ask them questions with both the brain and the heart hooked up to this machine. And sometimes they'd send in somebody that was kind of annoying or something to ask the questions, or it upset these athletes. And the heart waves would stop completely, and the brain waves would continue going. And then they'd put a basketball in their hand and say, now shoot some free throws, and their average would be like 2 out of 10 or something like that. And somebody else would come in. Pardon me?
I know it well.
Yeah. Somebody else would come in and they'd get them all excited, and the guy would be kind of like a motivational speaker and say, hey, tell me about that game where you made that three-pointer in the last 3 seconds. And all of a sudden, the heart waves would just start going off the chart, and the brain waves were clicking. And they'd ask questions like, what do you feel in your body right now? And the athlete would actually say, well, I can actually still feel like my skin's tingling, almost like I'm in that game. And they'd give them the ball and say, shoot some free throws. And they'd make like 9 out of 10. It's crazy. But when the heart is more involved than the brain, you'll do anything better, not just golf. Now, if you look at those two athletes we're talking about, golfers, Mickelson and Woods, I know they both have a lot of heart, But the question would be, whose heart is more in it? And I'd have to say Tiger Woods. Now, it's kind of interesting. I used to work for Jim McLean and heard Jim McLean say once, Tiger's going to struggle pretty. He's in for some struggles, he said, because he's going to try to learn how to draw the ball. And that was roughly 5 years ago. Now, I always kind of questioned that because I think Tiger Woods can do just about anything he wants with the golf ball. However, I do know that he was trying to draw the ball. And I think it was 3 years ago or 4 years ago he had his worst season ever. And I just recently looked into it, and I think that's the year his dad got sick. So I kind of wonder if maybe Tiger Woods just had a loss of heart for a while with his dad getting sick. Anyway,
a heart, some people call it a fire in the belly, right?
Yeah. And the amazing thing is it's such a big part of what we do with our life and our sports. And I mean, just think about some of the things that happen to you on the golf course. Maybe you're playing just one of the most beautiful golf courses you've ever stepped on. You feel so good that day, and you go, "Wow, I just hit so many good shots today. I love being down at Poppy Hills, you know, or wherever it is for the listener." Sometimes you'll just walk onto a tee and you'll look down the fairway and you just go, "Always liked this hole. I don't know what it is. It just fits my eye."
Mm-hmm.
I think probably the more appropriate way of saying it is, it really fits my heart. But
I've always had an issue when you're in a championship situation, whether it be the Super Bowl or the seventh game of the World Series, and the announcers always throw this out, "Well, it just matters on who wants it more."
Yeah.
And it's like, well, they both want it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's what you're getting at.
Absolutely.
These guys are professionals. Somebody's got to win and somebody's got to lose. And just because it goes to the bottom of the ninth inning before the game is over, does that mean they wanted it more?
There's a fine line. It almost has a point to do with if you want it too much, you start thinking about the future.
Mm.
I remember once Joe Namath was describing like the way he played football and some of his greatest escapades out there. He said it was almost like I was playing the game through my eyes. Wherever I looked, my receiver would go. And I could feel where I needed to move next. And it was almost like I was making the movie as it was going. It wasn't like the game was being played without me. If I stopped, everything else would stop. He said it was a weird, eerie type of thing. Even to the point where I think he described once where he needed to take a break, and the other team called a timeout. He said it was airy. In a way, it's when you're in that moment and you're not thinking about, are we going to win this game? What are the results going to be? Am I going to break par today? Am I going to, embarrass myself in front of my clients? When you're in the results, you're in for it. But when you can bring yourself back to the experience of just being in the here and now and having fun, you can tap into that other stuff. To the degree of it happening, like for Joe Willie Namath, I'm not sure. Or Sir Laurence Olivier, I don't know. Eventually, I think you could have those days. I really do. I think it's inside of all of us. I did this little thing just to learn what my students go through sometimes. I wanted to find out what goes through my students sometimes in playing bad golf. And I took some balls to the end of my driving range. And I had to hide when I did this because I took the weird grips and tried to make the strange swing paths and everything like that. And it was interesting. I knew how to fix this stuff, but I wanted to stay committed to not doing it correctly and find out why some people struggle with change. And you know, it's kind of funny. It comes from within. We all have a human nature that wants to, in a way, be right. And letting go of that is kind of difficult. While I was back there hitting balls with strange grips and like different swing shapes and stuff, I felt like, you know, like I was a small child just banging away on a piano key, you know, the keys, just making no music at all, you know. But I realized that I didn't want to abandon everything right off the bat, you know, because the creativity comes from just trying things. I'm not going to be able to swing like Tiger Woods is. You aren't, Fred, but you have a swing that somehow you could make it work. And you need to find out perhaps some of the things that might work for you. And they may be more on the lines of the fundamentals of the swing. But once you grasp one or two things, most of what's left comes in from your mind and how you believe in it. And I think, you know, we could probably, you know, search through swings on, especially the senior tour. You could look at some of the guys out there and go, how in the world can he actually hit it straight with that swing? It's amazing, you know? Yet, they believe. And I think that's a big, big principle in making our golf games better.
Well, it's interesting because a recent guest on the Golf Smarter podcast was Fred Shoemaker, and he said, increase your awareness and lower your handicap.
Oh, so true. Yeah.
Awareness. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, I'm going to just grill you on the fact that I shouldn't keep my eye on the ball.
As we make the turn, we want you to know that we're taking requests. If you'd like us to feature a specific course on Golf Smarter, our email address is golfsmarter@teetour.com. That's golfsmarter, one word, @teetour.com. Whether you're planning a golf vacation, playing in an upcoming tournament, or have a favorite course for which you have a question, please let us know and we'll do a show just for you. Again, here's your host for Golf Smarter, Fred Green.
We're back with Billy Bondurek, who is not only a regular writer for PGA.com, but also has a great website called the7mythsofgolf.com, and is also you an instructor or head pro?
I'm the lead instructor at Cotavadera Country Club in Lincoln, California.
There you go, the lead instructor. So in one of the seven myths of golf, Billy, you say a myth, keep your eye on the ball. Another one, keep your head still. Are you saying we shouldn't do those things?
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Okay, so should I be looking at the flag or my target and not the ball?
Well, what it is, Fred, when I say keep your, when they say keep your eye on the ball, it pretty much translates into both eyes. And if you really, you could actually do this without a golf ball. If you just stood up and looked at something on your rug or floor at home or something.
I'll do it while we're talking.
And, you know, keep both eyes on it and okay. Try to turn into your backswing. Try to make a big full shoulder turn. What will happen to you is your neck is going to stay half, it'll have to stay in place, straight up and down. And the further you turn, your head and neck will actually, if you're a right-handed golfer, will start to tilt to the left.
Mm-hmm.
And when your neck tilts to the left, it's one of the most sensitive areas of our body. In other words, if you injured your neck, you might not be able to wiggle your toes and your fingers. So your body recognizes this, and your body will always try to protect itself. So keeping your eye on the ball, which for most right-handed golfers would be a right-eye dominant thing, would mean that your neck would have to tilt to accommodate that. And as soon as your neck tilts to the left, you're going to have probably a development of a bit of a hip sway. In other words, your spine is going to swing over to the right. Your right leg will maybe even straighten out so that your spine can go in the same straight line as your neck.
Okay, I'm doing it, and you're right. I'm with you every step here.
interesting, in my book, I've got some pictures of Sergio Garcia, who I was down at the University of Arizona. I was a swing coach for the golf team down there. And his sister played on the team, and he'd come down a couple of times a year and visit her. And our Sergio's a nice guy. He didn't really particularly want to speak to me about his golf swing, but I did get a chance to take some pictures of him, and he was kind enough to answer a question I had for him once. As he was hitting his driver, and this video is in the Seven Myths of Golf. You can click on it and get to watch the picture. It's amazing how much he turns his face. And my question to him, and if you ever watch him from a face on view, even on TV, my question was, Sergio, how clearly can you see the ball out of your left eye? I wasn't even questioning the right eye, because I know he was completely blind of the golf ball with his right eye. And after he hit a couple more balls, he looked at me and he said, only sort of, kinda, not all so good. He literally turned his face so much. So this is the next experiment. As you're standing up now, instead of looking at that spot, get in your golf stance and turn your entire face to the right as you're tilting your spine and everything. And now turn and watch how much more free your whole body is to turn, because you're not looking down at the golf ball with both eyes. Do you follow?
Yeah, actually,
now,
I hope people are doing this with me.
The interesting thing is,
if you're wearing your iPod and you've got earphones in, you've got to be doing this with me. Come on.
The interesting thing is, though, if you watch golfers on TV, and you know this new thing that we have out, TiVo, is just awesome for golfers, because you can click back on a swing, and you can go up to your TV and put your thumbnail on the corner of their head and play it in slow motion. Watch how much these guys move their head. Watch how much they turn their face. Yet, those two myths are, I hear them all the time at practice facilities. A buddy says to his, you picked your head up, keep your eye on the ball. It's very damaging. I think I may have mentioned a story in my book about Curt Schilling. I used to teach him down in Tucson, and he had that problem in his golf swing, and it created all kinds of tension. And I remember I said to him, I said, Kurt, when you throw a fastball, do you feel any tension? And his answer to me, and I guess this is known for in the baseball world if you're a baseball pitcher, but he said, my mantra to throw a fastball is nothingness. And I thought that was so cool. I said, well, what do you mean by that? And he says, you literally have to feel nothing on the right side of your body as you're winding up to throw. And the same holds true for a golfer. And in order to do that, it comes back to your eyes. In order to lose that tension, you better move your head. Now, I'm not saying don't look at the ball. I'm saying see the ball. Don't look at it. See it and looking is two different things.
So what should we do? Should we move our head with our body?
Absolutely. Just let your head move.
Just trust the fact that you're going to make contact with the ball.
That comes down to really what your hands are very capable of doing. We have this proprioceptor nerve system in our hands and wrists and our fingers. And if you put your hand out in front of you and then remove it and put it right back, chances are you could put your hand in the exact same spot after a short period of time. Just dart your fingers out in front of you, Fred, and then pull it back towards you, and then back out. And you'll start to notice that your hand can get back to the exact same spot without any help.
Yeah.
Now, if you tried to do it with your eyes instead of the proprioceptors in your hands, you could get pretty close to it too. But you're bypassing a system that's much more effective. The reason I say that is because your hands occupy 42% of your brain. Your eyes only occupy 21%. So when we're looking at the ball with both eyes, we're trying to direct our hands back to it with our eyes. Yet if we were just a little bit more free with where our vision was, your hands will just swing down. You ever seen somebody that has just a beautiful practice swing and then they put a ball in front of them and it just looks different?
Oh, I know that person intimately.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. You're talking to him, pal.
Well, Fred, when you swing the club for a practice swing, chances are you're probably not really focused on anything down there. You see some grass, but you're not, like, looking at a specific blade of grass or, like, the dimple on the back of a ball. You're just seeing, like, a whole bunch of grass. Sometimes you're even having a chat with your friends as you're swinging, and you're making these beautiful sweeping motions that don't even take a chunk of turf.
There's nothing at stake.
Yeah, true. But that's interesting because that goes back to what we were talking about earlier. Having something at stake is probably the worst way to swing a golf club because that puts you into the results. Nothing should ever be at stake. You're just hitting a golf ball.
Well, that's what's at stake.
Yeah.
Is hitting the golf ball. So, how do you?
That's funny.
Thanks. How do you teach this to your students? I mean, what do you tell them to do? Do you actually tell them to not focus on the ball or not?
It's funny. And we're
and
all
how
different.
Do you teach us that?
I mean, I've worked with CEOs of major companies that all they do for their life is develop goals for, hundreds of people underneath them and stuff, and they're very goal-oriented people. And when I tell them they have to let go and stop being like that, they have a real hard time doing it. I said, hey,
Well, look at, they're a CEO. Why would they listen to you at that point? I'm sorry to say, you're a golf instructor, but
I'm not talking about their business. I'm talking
fine.
About their golf.
Okay, fine.
Which is completely different. And believe me, if they're a 20 handicapper, they should listen to me. I do teach some people out in the tour and stuff. These guys have trouble doing it because of their personality.
Mm-hmm.
Yet some of them, and I'm not going to say all of them, have experienced the letting go. And it enhances their life. They go out to the golf course and they know they're going to enjoy themselves no matter what happens over the course of 18 holes because they are not so goal-oriented. When we can let down those barriers instead of building them up as we go and getting more and more frustrated. I mean, think of it this way. Getting away from keeping your eye on the ball and you're supposed to move your head. Do you visualize your golf shots?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What does it feel like? Like when you visualize, say, a 250-yard, 260-yard drive down the middle and you slice it off to the right 50 yards.
Well, first of all, if I envision a 250-yard shot, I'm probably sleeping.
Okay. So maybe
I don't know if I've ever
maybe it's 210.
Okay, fine. That now we can talk that.
Okay, 210.
All right.
And you slice it right.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Now, you do that for four holes.
Mm-hmm.
You start to scratch your head saying, well, what's this visualization thing? Like, do it on every shot. Doesn't work for me.
Mm-hmm.
Now you're getting frustrated with it.
That's a mild term for it.
Yeah. The problem with the visualization... This is the finest players in the world. They do it, but then they detach from it. They know that they can't get stuck in the visualization because then they can't swing the club.
But they can analyze, and I mean, I'm sure that the pros can know at the top of their swing where their club face is and when their ball makes contact, where their club face is.
Yeah, doing it thousands and thousands of times.
Exactly.
They can do it with their eyes closed.
Right, and maybe they do hit the ball with their eyes closed. But I can't do that.
But when you make a practice swing, there's nothing at stake.
Yep.
Do you have a pretty good-looking practice swing?
Oh, I'm gorgeous.
So
I am so hot.
When you put the ball there, why does the practice swing change into something that causes shots out to the right or to the left or wherever? Because
but you know what?
You
my practice swing?
At stake.
But my practice swing? I don't know if my practice swing, the ball would have resulted on the right because I didn't hit anything. It may be the exact same swing. I may be able to bring that swing with me, but it's still going off to the right.
Okay.
Because I don't know where the club face is when it makes contact with the ball. And that really comes down to the only thing that matters, right, on a swing is the contact.
Uh-huh.
It's only that brief moment where there's the club meets the ball and that's
square
all.
Club face.
And that's what it's all about, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
So my practice swing may look good, but I don't know where the club head is.
I see. I see your point. That's a valid point. I think.
Thank you.
Somehow tension creeps into the golf swing.
Absolutely.
because the ball is there and something matters, whether it's just, you know, wanting to hit it in the fairway. And again, that's a desire. And hitting it to the right is a fear. But when you just don't care, and again, I'm probably explaining the shot that you once threw down an extra ball and said, I just don't care about this one, it doesn't matter. Whack, all of a sudden it's on the green. You go, where'd that come from?
No, generally I'd say, damn, I'm good.
Yeah. So getting back to that myth, though, that's something if you want to look at some swings on the tour, even Tiger Woods does it. He turns his face to the right. Vijay Singh turns it a whole lot. So does Sergio Garcia. And I think Vijay's head moves a good 8 inches to the right. Now, I'm not talking up and down. I'm just talking laterally.
Mm-hmm.
They move it behind the golf ball.
Okay.
Some of the drills that I would encourage somebody to do is actually get pre-tilted.
What does that mean?
Well, you're standing on 2 feet with the golf ball in front of you. Move the ball further towards the left foot. So
okay.
You're practicing with your 6-iron. And the ball is just ahead of center. Move it all the way up so it's off your left heel. Drag your right foot so it's almost touching your left foot. And then drop it behind the left foot.
Drop what behind the left foot?
The right foot. Drop it back. And then pick up your heel so that you're only balancing yourself with your right foot and you're standing with about 95% of your weight on your left foot.
Am I standing on my toe on my right, or just complete my right foot's completely off the ground?
Just the big toe's just there for balance.
Okay.
And then tilt your neck and spine like you're going to get ready to skip a rock. But of course, instead of a rock in your hand, you'd have a golf club. And just keep your right ear low to the ground, and just turn your face and your chest until your hands reach about shoulder height. This isn't really meant to swing any further back than about 3/4.
Okay.
And just hit some balls from that position.
Really?
What it really is it's kind of the impact position, and you're working backwards.
Am I using just one hand, or am I holding the club with both hands?
Both hands.
Uh-huh.
Both hands. That's a fabulous drill for anybody just to make practice swings.
Now, if you're listening to this on your iPod, and I hope you're on a train somewhere, I'd love to be watching. But back it up a little bit and do it while he's explaining that. You can do this, talk about TiVo, and get yourself in that position. I think, Bill, you described it really well. So I'm standing here doing this, so go ahead.
That's a great, the funny thing about learning something like this, I had mentioned something about our hands being 42% of our brain,
mm-hmm.
Eyes 21%. Because it's 42% of our brain, our hands are incredibly fast learners. You know, the synapses from your brain to your hands is something like 80 yards per second. But if you're thinking about body parts, like I'm going to try to learn how to make my lower body work better in the golf swing, much slower learning area, your legs, things like that. That runs on a synapsis of about 2 yards per second.
Interesting.
Which seems quick, but the difference is, it takes like a downhill racer a really long time to become a downhill racer. I think there was a little old lady that was 80 that once decided she wanted to learn how to play classical piano, and 3 years later she could play, Beethoven and played in front of a crowd. So, again, you have to realize body motion, you have to do body drills and do them constantly, and sometimes not without a golf ball.
Okay, so I'm still standing here on my left foot with my right toe, and I'm tilted over here with my club going at 3/4. What am I trying to accomplish?
The spine tilt, and if you're turning into your backswing, you should start letting your eyes move away from the ground a little bit, consistently keeping your neck tilted to the right, kind of like you're going to skip a rock.
Okay. So that's
that feeling of staying in that tilt is so important.
Right.
Most high handicap golfers come into the golf ball tilted forward with their spine, or tilted to the left, I should say. The best players in the world return to the golf ball with their spine tilted more to the right than they started at address. So if you just pre-tilt it and let your eyes drift away from the ball a little bit, you'll find it easier to be in the better position for impact.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
That's awesome. And listen, we only have 6 more myths to go. Are you going to come back? Talk to us some more?
Oh, I'd love to.
That would be great.
Yeah. Just remember this. I ended the first part of this with that thing about your golf swing. If it's not all that good, just find something that works for you. I told this to some students recently, and it causes a chuckle, but it's true. You can see some ugly swings out there in the senior tour, and they just believe in themselves. But recently I was reading The Ugly Duckling to my 3-year-old boy, and he was a little bit perplexed by it. He was a little confused with it. He didn't quite understand what had happened. So I was trying to explain it to him. I said, well, when did the ugly duckling become the swan? And he said, well, that's what I don't understand. I said, was he the swan before he saw himself? He said, yeah. He said, but he didn't know it. And that's the point. Some of us may have kind of an ugly-looking swing, an ugly duckling swing. But if you start believing in it and you get one or two things that work correctly, it doesn't matter what it looks like. If you believe it, it can turn into a swan for you. And that's the fun part about it.
And that's the challenge, yeah.
It is. Just believing in it. But thanks for having me, Fred. I really enjoyed the conversation with you.
Thanks, Billy. I enjoyed this, and thanks for the bedtime story.
You're welcome. Sleep well.
And that's Billy Bondurant, The 7 Myths of Golf, and some interesting, heady stuff. That's where we're going. You can check him out at 7mythsofgolf.com, and it's the number 7, M-Y-T-H-S, of golf, all one word. And find out more. It's a paid site. You have to become a member. But if you were intrigued by what he had to say, it's worth looking through because he has a lot of video on there, too, that really describes in detail what he's talking about. I'm just curious, if you've been listening to the Golf Smarter podcast for a while, you'll notice that I'm doing a lot more information from pros and instructors and tips and drills than I'm doing courses and course tours. Give me an email on that one. Tell me what you're thinking. If you want me to continue in that direction, are you missing some golf courses? If you'd like to hear some specific stuff, obviously very open to change on this. So I appreciate your feedback and just send it to golfsmarter@ttour.com. Now, our giveaway this week is provided by the Shivas Iron Society, which can be found at shivas.org, shivas.org. It's a beautiful, limited edition, leather-bound signed copy of Golf in the Kingdom, and it's valued at like $300 or something crazy. Now, this exquisite book is stamped and gilded in 24-karat gold, has a satin marker ribbon, and comes in its own handmade slipcase and individual gift box. And if you're a collector of golf books, this is a phenomenal prize. And if you're looking for a great gift to give to a golfer, which you are, and you know others, this is a great one to try to win so you don't have to buy it. Now, we're doing a random drawing of names from your email entries, and the winner will be announced on Tuesday, September 5th. So to enter, just send an email with the subject Kingdom to golfsmarter@ttour.com, TEETOUR.com, and include your name and mailing address, please, so we know where to send the book when you win. Now, just to be upfront about this, in exchange for this valuable book giveaway, we've agreed to provide the email addresses to the folks at the Shivas Iron Society, but thanks to them for giving this away. Check out Bunkershot.com, the golf magazine, for news, articles, and more, and don't forget to pick up your own set of Golf Smarter postage stamps. They come in sheets of 20 and can be picked up at Zazzle, which is zazzle.com/Fred Green. There's an E at the end of my last name. We end with our quote of the week, submitted by another listener. If you have a favorite golf quote, send an email with the subject golf quote to golfsmarter@ttour.com. And for those of you who've been sending him, thank you. I'm keeping a whole log of them so that we can run through them over weeks. And this week's quote comes from John Aloisi, who writes, Fred, I don't know about you, but I stress over the short putts much more so than the long ones because I think I should make them all. I was recently rereading Bobby Jones on Golf and came across a simple but profound short putting tip. Jones says, hit the putt as well as you can, and do not allow worry over the outcome to spoil the stroke. Thanks for listening to Golf Smarter. I'm Fred Green.